Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a trafficking conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Trafficking as in human trafficking. Human trafficking is stealing freedom for profit. It's a multi-billion dollar industry denying freedom to nearly 25 million people worldwide. My producer, Dave Rivas, has many talents. He was a 911 dispatcher for many years. He's a famous voice actor, play actor, and writer. One of his passion projects is acting in a play for schools to educate and prevent human trafficking. This High Truths podcast is about drugs and addiction, not human trafficking. But the more I learn about the methodology to prevent human trafficking, the more I realize that it applies to drug prevention as well. Human trafficking is attacked through primary prevention in schools. We need more of that for drugs. Each year, we pour more and more billions of dollars to the drug crisis, but don't move the needle. Why? I believe the reason is that we are disproportionately spending money downstream on people who have severe addiction at the expense of upstream primary prevention. We will not naloxone and we will not suboxone our way out of the drug crisis. If we want to stop the problem, we must go upstream and prevent the next generation of Americans from developing addiction. We did that with tobacco. That is how we solve the opioid prescription crisis. It's possible to do that with fentanyl and all illicit drugs. One important method of drug prevention involves school-based education. Sadly, most communities have abandoned evidence-based drug prevention programs. Dave Rivas, my wonderful producer, is an actor in an innovative school-based program to prevent human trafficking. There are many myths surrounding trafficking. It's not just a third world problem. It can happen under your nose, in your neighborhood, and your schools. It does not just involve kidnapping and violence. Many cases involve psychological manipulation and coercion. Traffickers are not always strangers. They're often romantic partners, parents, or family members. To learn more about trafficking and primary prevention of this crime, I reached out to Melissa Baldwin. Melissa Baldwin is a storyteller at heart. She received her degree in theater and spent over 20 years performing and teaching. So how does a storyteller actress get involved in the issue of human trafficking? We're going to find out. But Melissa immersed herself in training opportunities around the topic of trauma-informed care. She currently oversees No More. No, K-N-O-W, with no N-O in capital. No More, a drama-based human trafficking prevention and awareness program is developed by the Center for Justice and Reconciliation at Point Loma Nazarene University. No More is an interactive curriculum geared for middle and high school students and uses a dramatized story of Amanda. To learn more about Melissa Baldwin, No More, and Amanda's story, check out the High Truths show notes. Melissa Baldwin, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you for having me today.
I've been really looking forward to this episode. You're a busy woman doing very interesting things, and I want our audience to get to know you and understand your passion towards this. I learned about your work through our producer, Dave Rivas, who's an actor in one of your shows. So you are you studied theater, and now you're doing plays at schools for human trafficking. How did that happen?
The program was developed by our center. So we work out of the Center for Justice and Reconciliation at Point Loma Nazarene University. And it was developed by a whole group of people, actually, from the DA's office, from the San Diego Office of Ed, from various welfare agencies. They all came together and created this curriculum from data that they got from a research project that was done through our center, in conjunction with the DA's office and USD. It was the first major research research project that really studied a specific city's human trafficking situation. So really in-depth, first of its kind in the country. And then from that, they developed this curriculum. It was developed in 2017. There was someone running it at the time, and then COVID hit. So, of course, shut down for a little bit. I was hired coming out of COVID as students were going back into assemblies. And executive director of our center at the time was someone I knew from college. And she contacted me asking me if I knew of anyone that might be interested in doing this type of work. Or if maybe I would be kind of a situation. And when I took a look at the job description, I felt like it was written for me at the specific place that I happened to be personally in my life at the time. My background, like you said, is in theater. I've had a passion for child safety, for reducing sexual exploitation of children specifically. After coming through an interesting situation with my child and a teacher at their school who also worked with a local children's youth theater company, it just kind of really affected me and gave me a huge passion to fight sexual exploitation against children. And so the combination of that and the love of theater, et cetera, really drew me to this position. And coming out of COVID was really hard. It was really hard. Kids were somewhat dismature, weren't used to being in assemblies anymore, weren't sure how to behave. They had been, you know, the eighth graders had been sixth graders the last time they had been in school. And that is a huge difference in maturity. So it was really difficult starting off. I think the program has found a really incredible rhythm now, and I'm really proud of the work my team does. They're really incredible.
That's great. So your background is in, what were you doing at the university? You were a theater instructor?
No, actually, I had attended the university. That's where I got my bachelor's degree in theater. Then I had worked in theater off and on for about 20 something years with Lamb's Players Theater in San Diego. I had also taught high school drama a few times. At the time that I was hired for this position, I was at home with my youngest, who has some severe health issues and had been spending a lot of time really focusing in on those. And the timing for this position just happened to work out perfectly.
Oh, perfect. So we're going to learn more about that. And you also said in your background that you were very interested in trauma-informed care. So you were learning about that even before this opportunity came.
Yes, absolutely. So I'm a mom of five children. Only two are homegrown. The other three are adopted. And the thing about adoption that I think a lot of people don't realize is that every adoption starts with trauma. No matter when the adoption occurs, it's because a trauma happened in some way. And that trauma affects the children. And so as an adoptive parent, my husband and I went through a lot of training, and I especially just read a lot of books on trauma-informed care, how to respond to the behaviors that come up when someone is dysregulated, how to help them regulate again and get them out of that lizard part of their brain and into a place where they can calm down. So all of the trauma-informed care training that I had received as an adoptive parent and had also practiced as well as I could as I learned, really came into play, I think, when with this program, because we do encounter kids who have been through trauma. We work with survivors who have obviously been through trauma. And I think it's key when you're working with anyone, whether you know whether they have a trauma background or not, to always approach the situation and their behaviors with what is the need behind the behavior, not just addressing a behavior. And I think that speaks a lot to how we work with the middle schoolers and high schoolers. If there is a child that's behaving a certain way, we're not going to just discipline them or go get the, you know, counselor to take them out. It really has a lot to do with what's behind it. What is the need behind that behavior? And I think what really opened my eyes to that way of thinking was learning about trauma-informed care.
Now, you're teaching about human trafficking, but it's, what you're saying applies so much to the issue of drugs, right? First thing that we see is change in behavior in the classroom, and you don't know what is behind that. It could be drugs, it could be human trafficking, it could be something else, right? So do you see that overlap with the issue of human trafficking, which you're involved in with No More and the issue of drugs?
Yeah, so one of the big red flags that we talk about, and when we say red flags, what we're basically naming are those clues that you might see in someone that is being groomed for trafficking or is being trafficked. So the signs you might see in a victim that tells you something's going on with this kiddo, or you know, your friend or your family member. So one of the red flags is substance abuse. They start using substances, had not been using them before. There's a lot of overlap with drug use and trafficking. It is very easy for someone who has an addiction to be exploited into trafficking because they use that addiction to control the victim. They also will engage kids in grooming. They will groom children and get them hooked on drugs or alcohol as another means of controlling them. So there is a lot of overlap with substance abuse and trafficking.
Interesting. So the program is called No More, and I really like how the N-O is capitalized in No, K-N-O-W, No More. And tell us about this. You said it was a program with a lot of research behind it, and what is the purpose or how does it work?
So we use the research from the research project that was done, and those specific numbers, we're looking constantly to try to get more updated numbers. We don't have solid updated numbers. Like for the last couple of years, these numbers are really 2015 numbers, and those numbers have gone up. But we use what we found in that research project to inform the San Diego students about what it looks like, what human trafficking and grooming look like here in San Diego, because they look different in different cities. A lot of people assume we are near the border, so there's going to be all this trafficking down at the border. When the reality is in San Diego, 80% of the sex trafficked victims are U.S. citizens. And I think that surprises people, but those are the kinds of things we found out in the research project that we can kind of bust some myths, I guess, and give people a clearer picture of what it really looks like. The program's, like you said, drama-based. We use theater and characters to bring out the vulnerabilities that can be exploited in a teenager to bring out the red flags that we talked about earlier, those clues that something might be happening with someone. We talk about ways that a trafficker, kind of their methods that they use. And we also talk about how to keep them safe. And we also practice, how do you intervene as a friend? If you see these red flags, what are some ways that you can intervene and make a difference and maybe help change the trajectory of your friend's story?
Yeah. You know, and I'm thinking about this. We do this with children all the time, right? At kids, when they're 2, 3 years old, you teach not to go with strangers, you know, be careful of these things, right? We warn kids at a young age. And this issue of trafficking or drugs is another one of these dangers that we need to, you know, alert kids are. Now, the drama is based on a girl named Amanda. So tell us, who is Amanda?
So Amanda is a 15-year-old sophomore high school student in San Diego. She's very into academics, wants to be a journalist, has big hopes, big dreams. She lives in a single-parent household with a parent who works probably multiple jobs, is not home, is absent most of the time. And that's kind of where we meet Amanda, is in that situation. As a 15-year-old sophomore, you know, just a good student, lots of goals, lots of dreams. And
now, she's a fictional character or a real character?
She is a fictional character that was developed from stories that we had gotten from survivors, actual survivors. So the drama was informed by survivors' stories, those with lived experience.
Yeah, and I think that your promotional starts with a girl who says, yes, I was trafficked. And she tells a story that her mom had an addiction that led to her being trafficked, and then it became a family affair, right? That was pretty shocking.
Yes, and she was actually one of the lived experience experts that was consulted on this curriculum when it was first developed in 2017. And she had a break for a while she had a little baby, and now her baby's a preschooler, and she's been working with us again in the schools.
Right, and I assume she's doing okay, and is her mom doing okay?
Her mom is, it's a roller coaster with her mom. But she's, Ebony, our survivor, our lived experience expert, is doing really well. She has 5 kiddos of her own. Wow. Mom works, and she is fantastic with the students when she facilitates our program.
Wow. And so she actually comes as part of the drama or part of the education?
When we have availability with her, because she does work a full-time job. So we use her, and we're also looking for another survivor facilitator as often as we possibly can. There are times when they are not available, and when they are not, in place of them telling their story, we have a video of a man telling the story of his trafficking experience. The video gives it a nice contrast to Amanda's story because it, number one, it's male. Also, the perpetrator was a close family friend that mentored him, where in Amanda's story, it's an older man she meets online. So it gives kind of a nice contrast and shows all different ways that traffickers can work, and that their victims aren't always girls. There's also boys. But when we can, we like to have a survivor there with their lived experience. And they're always told that they can read the room and they can decide how much of their story they are comfortable sharing. And if they don't feel comfortable sharing their story, we'll use the video, and we'll just, you know, that is up to them at any point. They've been exploited enough, and we don't want to re-exploit them by using their story.
So I want to share with our audience a little bit, a little clip from Amanda. And this is a clip of her relationship with her, I guess, her trafficker-to-be. her boyfriend, and they're going from the texting relationship, and this is the first phone call.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, say something else, because your voice sounds older than 15.
I don't know what else to say.
Well, your voice is as beautiful as that pic you sent, Mandy. Can I call you that? It can be just between us.
Yeah, you can call me that.
You know, I don't know why, but you are different to me. It's not like with the other girls.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I know I just met you, but it's like I've known you forever. Do you know what I mean? Okay. Do you feel that, Mandy? I don't know, close to me?
Yeah, I do. I don't get it. I barely know you.
You know, sometimes it's just a feeling with someone. You know, it's like a connection. It's like a vibe. For real. Or maybe like love.
Yeah.
Yeah, hey, you know, I'm really sorry your friends aren't there for you lately.
Thanks.
Yeah, no, they must be cracked, because if I could be with you, I would never leave you for a second. You know, I think you're, amazing. Props to you and everything you've put up with. Oh, and, you know, I have been looking at that picture of you all day.
Yeah?
No, it pretty much got me through it. Hey, do you think you could send me another one? Maybe show me a little bit more of that beautiful skin.
Yeah, I can probably manage that, but later, after my dad leaves.
So, Melissa, we just saw Amanda with her first phone call relationship. With her trafficker to be, her boyfriend to be. And you could see how she's kind of uncomfortable, but she loves being flattered. Who doesn't like to be flattered? And so she likes that kind of attention. And from there, the relationship builds. Tell us more about that scene or where that leads, Amanda.
The scene, I think, is important because it shows some of the tactics that this man is using to groom her. He's in it for the long game, so he's not in a hurry. When he uses one tactic, like bringing up the emotion of love a little early, and it clearly kind of makes her uncomfortable, he changes tactics right away and starts talking about how her friends aren't there for her and things like that. It's that starts that isolation kind of tactic. Really, like I said, in it for the long game. So from that point, that conversation, they do move into, they meet at a party and they move into what Amanda thinks is a romantic relationship. And then he uses that romantic relationship to get her more and more and more dependent on him. And more and more and more isolated from her friends and her family, her circle of support. And then finally, after over 8 months, makes an ask of, I know this guy, and he said he would give me $200 for one night with you. Ask. And at that point, she has been manipulated so much. And that she says, okay, I'll help you out here. And that's how she gets caught up. And so the story does not end well. It ends pretty poorly with her in a life of trafficking. And we do that on purpose. We do that to provoke the students into considering how could that have changed? Why did it have to end that way? And were there things that could have been done that could have change the ending of the story? And we utilize that later on when we practice ways to intervene.
Right. So the kids get to see this with the terrible ending, but they are able to change the story or learn how they could be.
This is one of the best parts, I think, about the curriculum, and it's one thing that makes it so incredibly unique. There is something called forum theater or theater of the oppressed that came out of Brazil during a very difficult political time. And it really kind of utilizes improv. And there's a lot of really, really fancy words you can use to dress it up. But a lot of people aren't familiar with theater of the oppressed. So what I generally do when I'm talking, for example, to school administration or something about the program is we utilize improvisation. So we go back through scenes in Amanda's story with the actors doing the scene as written. And the students are invited to watch the two friends of Amanda. And when they see or hear something that they think one of these friends should have said or done differently, that could have changed the trajectory of the story and moved it in a positive direction versus a negative direction, they're encouraged to raise their hand and yell, "Stop." It takes a couple practices before they feel confident enough that they can actually yell this out in the middle of an assembly. So the students will do that. They'll yell, "Stop." And then I call them up and I ask them to take the place of that actor and do what they think that actor, that character should have done to change the trajectory of the story. And then my actors will play that out with the student. And the incredible thing about it is that when the students are coming up with the ideas on how to intervene for their friends, they own them. They're more apt to use them because they came up with them. Second of all, they're getting the chance to practice them. So if they come up with a suggestion that I think the best example to give would be when she tells her friends that this man is 21. And her best friend says, "Dang girl, you got yourself a man." Well, inevitably, the students raise their hands. Yep, you hear "stop" all over the room. And so I will call a student up. And usually, the very first thing they will try is responding with, "Well, he's a pedophile. That's wrong. You shouldn't be doing that." And my character, the woman that plays Amanda that day, the actress, will respond very defensively. This, because the statement, while being true, is a judgment statement. So the actress will react the way a friend would react if someone said those things to them. And so then we talk about, now, why is this not moving in a positive direction? You know, these judgment statements, while they may be true, are actually making her defensive. It's moving it in a negative direction. So what can we do? What can we change about our responses to make it move in a positive direction? And they really get to play these out. And so they try numerous things. And eventually what it comes down to, and I think what they really start to get, is we need to ask caring and curious questions. Because when we ask our friends caring and curious questions, it leads to conversation. They learn more about the situation. They get more facts. They learn more about what maybe the unmet needs of their friend are. And they know what they can do next. It helps them figure out the next steps. What do we do next to continue moving this in a positive direction?
So what would be the right way or the most effective way to dealing with, like, hey, 21-year-old, that's a pedophile. That's not going to get you. What is the good way of opening things up or having her see things differently?
So there are a number of ways that the students have come up with that have worked very positively. One is expressing how much they care. "Oh, wow, that's a lot older. I really care about you and I'm a little concerned. Can you tell me more about him?" Or, "So what is it you like about him?" Questions like that, because like I said, when they show they care and they show they're curious, then they start having a conversation. And Amanda reveals to them, "Well, what I like about him is that he listens to me and he's always there for me. And you guys have been ditching me and not around lately. And I'm home alone most of the time when my mom's at work." Basically, they find out she's lonely, right? There's this unmet need that she has. by asking these questions. And then that leads them to, okay, now they know about this unmet need, that she feels lonely. They're her friends. What could they do next, right? Well, they could make some solid plans. Hey, your mom's working tonight, right? Why don't we order a pizza? Well, you know, and so we really try to give them concrete things. Don't necessarily lead them. In some cases, you know, they're having a hard time. The students are having a hard time. So I will ask them questions to help them get to those points. But a lot of it is showing them that people that you talk to that are in situations that might not be safe for them, they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And so showing them you care is usually the best first step in intervening for your friend.
Interesting. Is there a point where you just say, danger, danger, this is a bad guy, you need to move away, I need to call an adult, this has crossed a red line, instead of just being a friend?
Yes. So in these cases, they're seeing red flags, but they aren't seeing, like, they haven't seen this man beat her, right? Do something physically to her yet. They're just seeing these changes that they're concerned about. And one thing we tell them, we ask them, because this is very, it's a conversation we have with the students. It's very interactive. So when I'm lead facilitating, I will say, do you think sometimes it's unsafe for an ally to help their friend? And of course, they'll say, yeah, it could be unsafe. So what do you do then? Well, they usually will come up with the answer pretty quickly. Those are the times you don't get involved and you find a safe and trusted adult. The safe, trusted adults are going to be different for different people, for different kiddos. For some kiddos, it might be a parent. For some kiddos, it might be a counselor at school. Some kiddos are comfortable and feel safe talking to law enforcement. Some do not. And so we want to be really careful that we're not saying, these are the people you should speak to. It's really a safe, trusted adult. Those are the key words.
Right. I mean, I'm just thinking the school nurse or something when Amanda has bruises on her.
Absolutely. Right? And they actually usually get there with the school nurse when we're doing that particular scene later. Yeah.
Yeah. So, right. I was thinking, it's like, okay, I could be a friend and invite you for pizza more often. But at some point, right, there's a red line that's been crossed. Like, she's been physically abused.
Right. And that is very last classroom scene that is in the play of Amanda's story, where they see the bruise, where she's clearly under the influence of something. And so they know then, they see she's under the influence. She's got this bruise. A lot of times the kids will suggest, help a teacher. They're in the middle of a classroom. And so some of them will be like, call the teacher. And it, of course, Amanda gets defensive and mad. She's been called out in front of everybody in the classroom. It's not effective. So they will try something else. And usually what they end up trying to do, or what they end up doing, students suggesting, is pulling the teacher aside and saying, Amanda's not feeling well. Can I please take her to the nurse's office? And that is always the best. I love it when they come up with that answer, because by offering to take her, well, first of all, they're keeping it private. So they're not embarrassing her in front of the whole class. They're getting an adult, safe and trusted adult involved, but then taking her, offering to take her, keeps her safe from the doorway to the nurse's office, and also make sure she gets there. In the scene, Amanda doesn't know what she took. She took a pill. She took something that this man gave her, and she doesn't know what it is. That makes it immediately a very dangerous red flag. So when they offer to take her to the nurse's office, it's very significant. It shows that they care about her, and it also makes sure she's safe on the way there. The other thing that happens is, in the script, right after this, she receives a phone call in class from this man that says, meet me at the park. And it's at the park where he makes his ask, you know, that he's been working up to. So when the students come up with the idea to accompany her to the nurse's office, I ask the students, okay, when her phone rings now, where is she going to be? You guys have just offered and taken her to the nurse's office. And they say, well, she'll be in the nurse's office now. I say, will she be able to leave and go meet Kyle? No, there's no way the nurse is going to let her leave the room at that point. And so they have interrupted the process without even knowing that's what they were going to do by showing their friend they cared, by keeping her safe, and by getting two safe and trusted adults involved in a very discreet way that doesn't humiliate their friend.
So this is a lot of pressure on kids or friends who may, when their friends have it, you know, a change in behavior, they might have, like, not want to even be around her, right? Like, she's acting weird. She's different. You know, the natural instinct for kids is, okay, I'm going to just stay away from that. And that's the whole point, right, is to isolate her. Is there a focus on Amanda herself of how she could behave differently or recognize?
Yes. So one thing before we go into the improv section that I will often do with students is talk about the power of story, right? Stories can move us. They can change us. They can challenge us. And I encourage them to look at their lives as a story. You know, they started chapter one, they're born. Chapter two, the toddler years. Chapter three, the elementary school years. I tell them usually we're going to skip the middle school years because those are usually pretty bad. Now you're in the high school years. Who's the author of your story? And they will inevitably say, I am. I'm the author of my story. Yes, you are the author of your story. And that gives you agency. That gives you a lot of power. That means if you find yourself in a plot line that is unsafe, or that you think is moving in the wrong direction, you have the agency to change your plot line, to change the direction of your story. From there, we go into the influences. Who contributes and influences your story? You're the ultimate author of your story, but who contributes to it? Who influences it? And then we move into the friends and what the friends in Amanda's story could have done differently. When we have a longer period of time, because we have a shorter version of this program that's about 2 hours, and then we have one that's 3 hours, we have occasionally done the improv where they can go in for Amanda. We honestly usually don't have the time to cover all of the material and also do that. So we're really trying to focus in on these characters, these two friends that see all of these red flags. And they either encourage the dangerous behavior or they ignore it, or they just don't do anything. They don't care. Depends on which scene it is. So that's generally what we will focus on because that's what we have the time to do.
I just see that this is so applicable to the issue of drugs. When I, you know, as you know, I'm an emergency physician, and I sadly treat a lot of people who have overdosed on fentanyl, either knowingly or unknowingly. And when they wake up, I ask them, you know, what drug did they think they took, and also their journey to drugs. And invariably, it starts in middle school at a very young age, you know, as young as 9, 10, 11. And the very first drug that they ever used was marijuana, and usually introduced from family or friends. And I just see what you're saying so applicable on teaching and practicing ways of avoiding that and changing your life story or your narrative because of the pressure and surrounding and whatever these kids are escaping from that gets them into drugs or, you know, either their trauma or their life circumstance and how to manage that. And I think it's applicable really at that young age.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. And so I'd like to ask, what about the reaction of your actors? And, you know, our producer, Dave Rivas, is one of the actors. This is one of his passion projects. But besides Dave and other people, what are the actors' reaction in doing this show and interacting with kids?
It's been really fun to watch my team become engaged. I've noticed that a lot of, they're all local professional actors in the San Diego area that we hire to do this program with us. And we refer to them as teaching artists because they do get involved in the teaching that we're doing. But I will watch it kind of spill over into their lives, right? I'll notice that on social media, they're starting to post things about trafficking or consent and, you know, things like that, that I know they didn't do before. So I know it's affecting them. I also know though, and we talk about, we do a trauma training during rehearsals and we talk about vicarious trauma and how they need to take care of themselves too. Because they are talking about a very tough subject. And oftentimes we see reactions from kids that tell us very clearly that they are relating to something that is being said on stage. And that can take a lot out of someone if they're doing it all day long or several days in a row. So I know that I've had some of my actors say, I got to go home and I have to take care of myself because there's just so much emotion, such a heavy and raw topic. The other thing I think is the camaraderie that the team builds with one another. We do a lot of, in rehearsal, we do a lot of trust kind of exercises where we learn a lot about each other. And I see this bond with them. And I think that bond shows to the kids. I think the kids see it. And I think that makes a difference, to see people that care about each other working together toward a common goal. So I've really enjoyed watching. I feel like a mama bear when it comes to my team, although some of them are maybe my age or might be a little bit older. I don't know. I still feel like a mama bear. And I always feel like I want to take care of them.
I think it's very insightful to you to realize that this is provoking to the actors as well. And I noticed that in my job, well, as an emergency physician, our whole life is trauma and we sadly ignore it. I think that's what leads to a lot of burnout in my profession. But I've noticed it in, you know, our DEA agents and who go to overdose after overdose over overdose. How many dead bodies can you see before it like really affects you? How many families do you have to like meet and tell them that their child died? That has to be painful to the person who's working these scenes, not just, you know, the families who are obviously devastated. But so, yeah, I commend you for noticing that and mitigating that.
Well, and trying to.
Yeah. And it is. I think it is impactful to the actors. It makes them behind your movement as well.
I think the other thing that I realized watching the actors is I've watched them grow in how they interact with the students. And part of that is that trauma-informed approach where they might just get irritated with the students who might be misbehaving. I find them start to engage with the student first before they say, hey, you know, you need to stop goofing off over there or whatever. But really start to engage with them first, and they're just immediately being punitive in the way that they treat the students. And I've watched some of my team just evolve in the way that they interact with the students. And Dave has always been, your producer has always been really good at this. He had one student that he had to ask once to, I think it was put away his phone or something. And Dave just kind of goes over and he just goes, hey, dude, you know, put away your phone kind of thing. And or maybe he moved him. I don't remember the exact thing. But what I do remember is this kid's attention for the rest of the time was fully focused on. And Dave went up afterwards and gave him one of our incentive candies and said, hey, man, thanks for doing what I asked you to do. And the guy just like fist bumped him on his way out. So they've turned this situation that could have been very combative into something that created relationship between the two of them. So I thought it was great.
That's awesome. So reaction from students, and I want to share with the audience a little clip from your promotion of Know More about some the kids' impression of Amanda.
I learned that trafficking in general can happen to anyone, no matter race, ethnicity, or gender.
Sex trafficking can happen in a lot of places where you feel safe. To me, I never thought it could happen in anything that was populated. I just felt like it was a lot more like in dark places that didn't happen to have a lot of people around them.
I'll try to pay closer attention to the people close to me and see, try to notice any differences in their behavior, and also just be like more cautious in general, because now I know that like recruiters can be anyone. It's not just like older men. It can literally be like girls my age, so I'll be more cautious.
What I've personally learned is that it's not just in the movies. I mean, we see a lot of film and we hear a lot of stories about these things happening to people like down in the alleys and just in these dark hidden places. But what we don't understand is that it is everywhere. It's in San Diego, it's at the schools, it's at the malls, it's where we don't expect it, which is the most dangerous.
So Melissa, I watched this clip of your promotion of Know More and the kids' reaction to the play and learning about Amanda and human trafficking. And I was just really impressed with these kids. First of all, are they real kids? Is this rehearsed or is this natural? Because they speak so intelligently and precise on what they learned.
They are actual students that had sat through the presentation. It was not rehearsed. Wow. We had someone, our videographer was just asking them questions and they were answering them. And it's really phenomenal. Every now and then we'll get feedback. A teacher will have her class after seeing the presentation write little notes to us or things like that. And I love reading them because the students get different things out of them, depending, of course, on their own experiences and what they relate to most. But they're just like those kids you see in the video. And, you know, that whole idea of, and they're learning facts, right? Some of the myth busting has happened and they realized it. They've realized that maybe stranger danger is a good thing to teach your kids, but it also gives you a false sense of security, right? Because it could be someone that you know. So when you're breaking up these myths, I think that sticks with them. Like, wait a minute, I thought it was this and it's really this. I think it sticks with them.
Yeah. Do the kids relate to Amanda or they are like, that's not going to happen to me. Like, this is silly. Like, why do I need to watch this?
I have found that they relate to her. And I think part of the reason it does is our actors look pretty age appropriate. Now, all of our actors are over 18, but because they're close to that peer age group, I think it makes it easier for them to relate. We also are really careful. I know when I'm directing, I'm like, every line is really important and they cannot be done in a cheesy way, right? It needs to be real. I think that's something about their acting ability that the students are able to relate. I think really that when we pull out the vulnerabilities that Amanda has in her story, people see them in themselves because we name these vulnerabilities and all the different vulnerabilities and how, yeah, there's some circumstances that might make someone more susceptible to being trafficked, but really it can happen to anyone. And I think that's what really hits hard with them.
Yeah. And it's scary. So how do you measure your success in these programs? Where is this just San Diego specific? Is just San Diego public schools? How do you get into the schools? How can schools reach out to you? Or I imagine schools don't even know. This is such a hidden problem. Nobody even thinks that, that doesn't happen in my school.
Well, actually, when we did the research back in 2015, they did research in 20 local San Diego high schools, and 18 out of the 20 had documented cases of trafficking and recruiting happening on their campuses.
How do they know that? That is crazy.
Yeah, I wasn't involved in the research, so I'm not sure how they gleaned that exact information.
Wow.
But that's just really impactful to hear that. Way that the news has, like I said, coming out of COVID, it was really slow going there for a while, getting back into assemblies and things like that. But the word of mouth, I think, is what is really doing it. Now, there is a state mandate in California that schools must give human trafficking prevention information at least once in middle school and once in high school. However, there is no funding for that, and there is no guidance for what type of curriculum, what needs to be covered, et cetera. And schools don't have the time to create a curriculum. So that's where programs like ours can step in and take that over, help them meet the mandate without adding that extra burden of what exactly do we say? What do we cover? All of those things. As we have gone over the last 2.5 years, we've watched the steady increase of schools, and most of it has been word of mouth. Oh, my friend's a counselor at this school, and she said, I really needed to talk to you about coming to our school, kind of that situation. We also have some really good advocates. We have a really good advocate at the San Diego County Office of Ed, Charisma de los Reyes, that worked in the foster care system for many years and now works at the Office of Ed and is passionate about protecting our children. She's such a strong advocate. So we went, just to give you an example, in the school year 22-23, we had 19 presentations. And those were spread over, I want to say, about 5 different schools. And this past school year, 23-24, we did 72 presentations.
Wow.
So we went from 19 presentations to 72 presentations, more than doubled the number of schools that we went into. It's really the word of mouth, I think, that's getting it out. I think you also, in our promo video, we have the head of physical education from Patrick Henry, Terry Clark, another huge advocate for our program. She had a niece that was trafficked and is extremely passionate about the subject. And because she's head of the PE department, and that fits in really well with human trafficking curriculum, they do, health type lessons. At her school, she brings us in for the PE as part of the PE curriculum. And then she's told her other friends, and they've, at other schools, other PE teachers, or it just, that word of mouth goes, and it helps to have those advocates out there.
That's awesome. And your audience, is it like a critical number? Just, you can't have a big assembly, right, with 1,000 people. Otherwise, is there like a critical size of audience that this works well with?
Now, we usually limit it to 100 students. Okay. If it gets any bigger than that, because we are so interactive, we're always asking them for their thoughts and ideas. We wouldn't be able to do that.
Right.
It wouldn't be as relational. The intimacy would be lost. And we wouldn't get that interaction where they feel like they're actually involved in solving the issue.
Wow. And I love the concept you have of an exit slip. Tell us what that is.
So our exit slips are, we call them their exit ticket. It's like, this is how you're able to leave the room today, kind of thing, is what we tell them. But they get passed out, and every student has to fill it out, and they have to put their name on it, their student ID on it. And then there are 3 boxes. And next to each box, the first box says, I still have questions after today's presentation. The second box says, I need to talk to someone about me or a friend. And the third box says, I'm good. I don't need to talk to anybody. But they must check a box. And when they leave, our teaching artists collect those at the door. We don't look at names, student ID numbers, because of FERPA. We're trying to be very, very clear with privacy. But we do count up how many were turned in, how many checked box 1, and how many checked box 2. That helps us when we go for grant funding, that we've got evidence-based, you know, that this is making some sort of a difference. Then we take those slips and we give them to our primary contact at the school, which is generally a counselor or an administrator. Because we come in, we give them all this information, and then we leave. And there are students who are saying, I have more questions and I need to talk to someone. And we want to make sure that they get follow-up. So that's really what those exit tickets are for, so that students can reach out without having to go talk to someone, you know, make that initial, it keeps them on the counselors or the administrators' radar. It gives them the opportunity to call a student in and say, I know you have questions. So what were your questions? So they get some follow-up. They're not just falling through the cracks after they've seen this.
What percentage of kids check box number one or two?
It really varies. I would say on average, about 3%. So if you figure 100 students at a school, three students are saying, I have questions, or I need to talk to someone about me or a friend. Now, to be quite honest, sometimes it does not have to do with human trafficking. Sometimes it has to do with domestic violence, or it has to do with some other form of trauma. But because we have talked about intervening, how we've talked about being, we call them upstanders versus bystanders, it brings up a lot of different things. And we talk about vulnerabilities. So these kids are going to get follow-up, whether it's about human trafficking or whether it's about some other issue that was brought up in them because of what we've discussed.
Yeah. And like I say, I see this so applicable to the issue of drugs or just teaching healthy life skills, right? This is applicable to a lot of things, not just human trafficking. So I think that's why I really wanted to talk to you and learn from you and really commend you for what you're doing and how you're in a creative and effective way in educating and in primary prevention. This is primary prevention for human trafficking. I think it'd be primary prevention for drugs or violence or other issues as well.
Yes, thank you. I've really enjoyed talking to you about the program. As you can see, I'm a little bit passionate about it.
I love that.
but I'm so happy to be able to share with you today. Thank you for having me.
That's great. And maybe one day I could come and watch. Is that possible?
It is. We have to get permission from schools, okay, of course, because we're bringing someone on campus. But that's always a possibility. So yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, I'd love to do that and even maybe bring somebody else from the DA's office or educational board to watch and see if that could be adapted to issue of drugs.
Yeah, that'd be really interesting.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you again.
And thank you to Dave. And also, yeah, right, shout out to our buddy Dave who made this happen. He was so inspired by being part of the program that we're doing this episode.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.